Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, May 27th, 2007, and this is show number 98. Getting pretty close to show number 100 now, aren't we? Well, hey, I've been thinking a lot about the shareware I use as I rebuild my disk since the big crash of 07, and it makes me realize how important these applications are to my workflow, and to appreciate even more the effort the shareware developers go to in order to make my life easier and more fun. I want to make a plea to all of you to pay your shareware fees, even when they don't make you do it by watermarking or giving you a limited capabilities until you do pay them. We want to keep this great community of developers in place to keep creating software, so pay them, okay? One I've used for at least 10 years now is called Mac Tracker, and when I downloaded the latest version to the new disk, they had a donation button I'd never seen before. They didn't suggest what I should pay, but since I've used it so much, I decided $30 was at least what I owed them. I like it when they remind me, helps keep me honest. If when you're done paying your shareware fees, you have a few extra bucks left in your wallet and you can't figure out what to do with them, you could always push the donate button on podfeet.com and help support the podcast. But pay the shareware guys first, okay? I really mean that. Well, after I posted on the show last week when I talked about my choice of the Timbuktu Messenger laptop bag, where I mentioned that the only thing I regretted was that there was the strap had no padding on it, I posted the same comment to the message board where I found all those helpful women that had told me about the best computer laptop bags. If you don't believe me that they're fanatical, by the way, I put a picture of Jenny's bag collection in the show notes. She's got a real problem, needs like a 12-step program or something. Anyway, back to my complaint that the Timbuktu bag did not have a padded shoulder strap. Within seconds, Pat, Deb, and Jenny all told me that Timbuktu sells accessories. Of course. Well, the first accessory they all recommended was padding for the strap. I ran over to Timbuktu's website and ordered myself the add-on strap padding, and I chose the rubberized one so that it won't slip off my shoulder. I destroyed the case on my titanium PowerBook once when my shoulder strap slipped off my shoulder. I swear I didn't even lean over, it just slipped off. So I think I'll give my MacBook Pro a fighting chance this time by a rubberized shoulder pad. It was only $10 for the accessory, which seemed like a fair price, but the shipping was $9.50. Oh well, my comfort and my laptop's comfort was worth it. Again, thanks ladies for all the help. I really appreciate the advice. Remember last week I was asking for a podcatching tool that everyone could use, regardless of operating system, and I expressed my disappointment that my podder from Podcast Ready was just teasing when they showed download buttons for Windows, Linux, and OS X, because only the Windows button worked. Well, luckily, Donald Murphy from Podcast Ready saw my post about this and wrote in with a clarification. Here's what he said. I saw your post about the podcatching client from Podcast Ready, MyPodder. In order to synchronize your subscriptions with the website for management, we require an account to be created before downloading. This allows us to match up your user account with your copy of the software. The Windows button download something because the installer requires a user account to install the software in order to accomplish the same task. If you have any questions, feel free to contact me. Thanks and have a great week. Well, hey, Donald, thanks for writing in. I headed over to podcastready.com and created an account. And guess what? Donald is right. They do have a download for lots of operating systems. I downloaded and installed it on OS X and on Windows XP. Next week, I'll talk a little bit about my Linux experience as well. MyPodder opens pre-populated with a bunch of podcasts to get you going, which is great for the newbie. They did a nice sampling of a few mainstream media podcasts, like ABC News and ESPN, but they also had things like Slashdot Review and Slice of Sci-Fi. These are referred to as channels, and there's a separate podcast tab. Not quite sure yet what constitutes a channel versus a podcast, though. They also have a tab to change options like where you want your files stored, how to configure a proxy in case you're behind a firewall, and even how to back up your channel listening to an OPM file. On the opening screen, they have a button that says Find More Podcasts. When you click that, it tells you that it's going to close MyPodder and go to the Podcast Ready website. This seems kind of odd. Wonder how I'll know when to relaunch the application. Well, I decided to trust it. At podcastready.com, I searched on the best podcast of all time, of course, the NoSillaCast, and to my great excitement, it was listed in there. I hovered over the buttons, and the plus button added it as a subscription. I wasn't sure what to do next, so I launched MyPodder again, but NoSillaCast wasn't listed there with the others. Went back to podcastready.com and messed around a bit, deleted a bunch of podcasts except for mine and Slashdot. Then I noticed a little arrow next to my podcast and hovered over it to reveal that if I clicked it, it would download or play the podcast episode. Now I got a nice little window with three buttons. The little butterfly thingy means to send the episode to your private channel. Then there's an arrow to play and a down arrow to download. They also put the beginning of the RSS describing the podcast episode in this nice little window. I put a picture in the show notes showing you what it looks like. It even brought in my nice logo. I went back to MyPodder and clicked Refresh Channels, and now NoSillaCast came in as a private channel. Next to it, there was a button for website, so I thought I'd see if it took it to my website, but it didn't. It took me back to Podcast Ready. I don't really think that's what it should do. That doesn't seem quite right. Seems like if it's specific to that podcast, you would go to that podcast website. Oh well. At the bottom, it had a button to download the shows. I told it to go ahead, but after it ran for a while, I realized that it was still downloading for all the channels it had to start with. It had not narrowed down to the two I had told it to use on the website. Well, that didn't make me happy. I clicked on one of the podcasts I didn't want and found a delete button. So I went through the delete process again and again through all of them on MyPodder. I'm going to ask my new friend Donald why they chose to do it that way. Oddly, when I added a podcast on the Podcast Ready website, it did show up on my player later in OS X. So it's just a problem with deleting them online doesn't make it delete them in your MyPodder. I should mention that during the download process, they show a nice looking icon of a USB device, which I should explain. On their website, they explain that they not only support all of these operating systems, they support all kinds of player devices, not just iPods, but any MP3 player, video player, basically any USB device. I love this. This thing is really agnostic, so everybody can play. I noticed in the My Options tab, it gave me an option of where to store the files, and it allows you to keep them in three separate directories for audiocasts, videocasts, and photocasts. I think I was supposed to have my hardware player attached when I did the download, but it still worked great and put the files on my disk where promised. I won't go through the whole installation again to explain how it works on Windows, but I did want to point out one big difference. When you download MyPodder on Windows, it brings up an interactive screen that walks you through step-by-step when to plug in your portable device, logging you into your account, or signing up right there. I think it's really well done, and I kind of wish it had been that way on the Mac side, just like that. Windows users even get an option to have MyPodder launch when the portable player is attached, which is an excellent feature, something I definitely like about iTunes. Probably the happiest moment in my experimentation was when MyPodder launched in Windows, and it was configured exactly as I'd set it up on the website, and later on in the Mac version, with only Slashdot and NoSillaCast as my channels. Seemed like it was a little better integrated in Windows than it was on the Mac side. I added the Mac ReviewCast to my subscriptions on the Podcast Ready website, and then launched MyPodder on OS X on Windows XP, and I set them side by side. The two versions handled the new subscription fairly differently. On OS X, it added the Mac ReviewCast as a new podcast series, but on the Windows version, it added the single episode as a subset of a channel it created that included the NoSillaCast. I suppose it's remotely possible I did the subscription differently, but I'm pretty sure I did it the same way. And it seems like if it were synchronized, it would show up the same way. All in all, I'm sure glad Donald wrote back, My only advice to the development team at MyPotter would be to have some text on the Podcast Ready site that explains why the non-Windows download buttons don't work on the website until you create an account, or figure out a way to make the download work without an account like it does on Windows, which would be even better. My advice to you is if you're looking for a podcatching client that integrates into your operating system, no matter what operating system you're running, and integrates into your media player, no matter what media player you like, then you really should check out MyPotter from podcastready.com. Thanks, Donald, for helping me get this going. Last week, I promised that this week we'd learn about the anti-lock brake system from Honda Bob's website at hdabob.com. Honda Bob puts a great deal of work into making his website a useful source of information, not just for Honda owners, but for anyone who wants to have a better understanding of the components of their car. Say, for example, before you subject yourself to a regular mechanic. I can't stress highly enough that if you're in the LA area and you drive a Honda or an Acura, you'd be so much happier if you had Honda Bob come to you than if you go to one of those sleazy places, you know, the kind where you consider yourself lucky if they simply rob you blind, but at least you got your car fixed. You know what I'm talking about. What if you could have Honda Bob just come over and fix it and not steal you blind and the car still gets fixed? On Bob's website, where he explains the anti-lock braking system, he points out that it modulates the pressure of the brake fluid that is applied to both the front brake calipers and or both rear calipers, preventing the wheels from locking up. He goes on to point out that there's a sensor that the system monitors so that if one wheel is turning slower than the others, the anti-lock brake system releases pressure to the wheel. I did not know that. The most important thing Bob explains is that if the ABS indicator light comes on in your car, get it checked out right away because you could find yourself in a dangerous situation with no support from your anti-lock brake system. For more car tips like this, head on over to hdabob.com, or better yet, have Bob come over and work on your Honda himself. Well, it's not a successful NoSillaCast if I don't mess up at least one thing, and at least one of you doesn't call me on it. Remember all the fun we had with Fausto? Everybody remembers that. Well, this week, Bart caught me in a serious misrepresentation of the truth on my explanation of Clicky for WebStats. Here's what he said. Hi, Allison. Just listening to this week's cast. I know I'm late. Just been a hectic time. You said, quote, without loading a darn thing on your website, you can get terrific statistics. Well, this piqued my interest because it sounded like some kind of black magic. So as I always do, when something sounds like black magic, I dug in a little deeper. What their website says is, by including just two lines of HTML code on your website. Well, two lines of code on each page I want to track is a big darn thing to me. Looks nice, though. I particularly like the fact that it still works even when users have JavaScript disabled. That's a nice touch and a point where Google Analytics falls down. Since I generally browse with scripting off, I'm invisible to Google Analytics. Well, Bart, you caught me. I remember this niggling in the back of my mind, wondering how it does do this magic. Of course I had to put some code on my site. I just forgot that I did it. By the way, you don't have to put the code on every page you want tracked. Simply put the few lines of code in the footer of your content management system, so it'll be there on all the pages. Thanks for bringing my faux pas to everyone's attention. Well, Bart's comments were not all correction. He also sent in an audio review of a tool called Color Oracle. Here's that review.
Hi, folks. This is Bart from bartbuchas.ie again. Judging by the fact that less people have started using JavaScript, according to Allison, someone actually listens to what I say, which is cool. So here I am to say some more. Anyway, last time was all serious security stuff. This time it's all just a little bit more lighthearted. The tool I want to talk to you about today is called Color Oracle. It's a very serious tool for a very small number of people, and for everyone else, it's just a bit of fun. So basically, the idea of this tool is that it lets you simulate what stuff looks like on your computer to colorblind people. So if it's your job to design color schemes, to design interfaces, to design web pages, then it's very, very important that you make sure that they're actually usable to people with the various different types of color blindness. But if that's not the kind of thing you do, then really this is just a bit of fun. I actually find it quite disturbing because I am slightly colorblind, but not too badly. And one of the types of colorblind, when I changed it over, at first I didn't actually notice that the colors had changed. But when I looked very closely at some of the different icons, I did notice a bit of a difference. Whereas the other types of colorblindness, I was just like, oh my god, that's amazingly different. Anyway, so the tool is called Color Oracle, and I'm going to give Alison a link to stick in the show notes. And basically, it's a Windows, Linux, and Mac application. It started off on the Mac because the Mac version is stable, and the Linux and the Windows versions are both beta. I haven't tested Linux and Windows versions because I'm just a mad Mac user, so I just installed it today and had some fun with it. Anyhow, so once you install it and you run it, you get a little menu in your menu bar, which looks like sort of a color palette, and when you click on it, you get a drop-down list which lists different types of color blindness. As soon as you click on a certain type of color blindness, all your screen colors change so that your screen looks like it would to a person with that particular type of color blindness. Nice thing about this is that it's very, very easy to undo that change. If you click your mouse or you press any key, immediately everything goes back to normal, which I think is a nice touch. The other nice touch is if you're using this for actual work rather than simply for, you know, fun, as I'm sure most of us will be doing it for fun. Anyway, if you're doing it for serious, you can also map hotkeys to the different types of color blindness. So while you're working, you know, you're playing with a color scheme or whatever, you hit F5, let's say, you get one type of color blindness, F6, you get the other type of color blindness, press any other key, everything goes back to normal, you continue working, you test it again, and so forth. So it's actually an exceptionally powerful and exceptionally useful tool. I know I'm slightly colorblind, I'm not very colorblind, but I am a little colorblind, and one of the types of colorblindness, when I set it up on the machine, at first I didn't notice that anything had changed at all. But then when I had a close look at some of the icons in my dock, I did see some subtle differences. But actually, for me, the difference between normal and that particular type of colorblindness, I can't remember which one, and I couldn't pronounce it anyway, was very, very little. Whereas when I played with the other types of colorblindness, the difference to me was absolutely staggering. Now, while we're on the subject of colorblindness, I do want to mention one other tool, but I'm afraid it's a Mac-only tool, so it's not one everyone can play along with, but it's called SimDaltonism, SimDaltonism. Again, I'll give Alison a link to stick in the show notes. And the reason I mention it is it does something very similar to Color Oracle, but not quite the same. Rather than changing your entire screen color, it adds up a little window, and as you move your mouse around, the area around your mouse is shown in that window with the different types of color blindness, which is, to be honest with you, much less usable than the Color Oracle one. It's also not cross-platform. The reason I mention it is because it supports different levels of the different types of color blindness. So it's a little more powerful in that sense, but although if you're using this in a professional capacity, the people who are less colorblind aren't going to be as badly affected as people who are very colorblind. So really, if you test your stuff for the people who are very colorblind, you're going to be fine anyway. So it's probably not more powerful in that regard, but since it does have that one extra feature, I figured I may as well mention it. Anyway, have fun.
Thanks, Bart. It sounds to me like Color Oracle and SimDaltonism are both tools that help with accessibility, and I'm all for that, as you know. We don't think of colorblindness as a disability, but it sure can make life difficult for some people. My son is slightly colorblind. I remember he used to refer to our cat Mulligan as the brown cat when he was little, and Mulligan was, of course, gray. That's how I figured out that he was missing something in the whole cone region of his eye. You might be thinking he was missing something else, like, why didn't he just call the cat Mulligan? Oh, well, something wrong with him anyway. Well, thanks for the review, Bart. I'll check that out. Speaking of web statistics, I'm getting a lot of suggestions on other sites that provide cool statistics. So, Niraj, evidently I'm not the only one with this anal obsession with data. Tim wrote in and he said, your most recent podcast mentioned Clicky as a site monitor. I thought I would point out SiteMeter from SiteMeter.com. That's SiteMeter.com. I use it on the website I maintain. It gives me a counter of all my visitors since inception on my site. As webmaster, I have access to even more information. It is interesting to see where visitors come from, browser information, etc. Check it out. This is also a free service, but they do offer a paid model as well, which presumably gives much more information and has no advertising on the statistics pages. Another very nice feature is that I can tell it to not recognize my machine IP address, because I visited a lot, and now it will not skew the results. Nice feature. Well, Tim sent along a link to a sample monitored site, so I put that link in the show notes so you can see what it looks like. Thanks, Tim. I checked out your site statistics, and it looks pretty comprehensive. I like the worldview that SiteMeter gives, too. You can choose to have the location of your visitors shown on a globe-style map, which can be set to show you where it's nighttime. Pretty nice graphics. SiteMeter also lets you view by continent, and you can zoom in on the map. This is probably the best map statistics I've seen. Well, Susan wrote in a nice message about statistics, too. Allison, may I send you virtual flowers as well as kudos on 2-year and number 100 podcast? Well, of course you can, Susan. Your kudos and virtual flowers are graciously accepted. Well, she went on to say, hey, stats are great. Your appreciation of Clicky's analytics is right on target, as there's so much to learn about your audience. By the way, Clicky is much like webstats.com. Before I read more of what she wrote, I need to tell you that webstats.com is now a link farm to a web statistics site. I shot her a note asking her to double check the URL, but let's listen to what else she had to say anyway. Webstats was used on an education project we did. It was a computer security training package on the buffer overflow. These projects were funded through education to build up a cybersecurity core, and they typically lost interest. Our statistics were scary, though. Only a third of the users were in the United States, like West Point and a few schools teaching security. Seeing that somebody was playing with our stuff at Jerry's Internet Cafe in Islamabad made me wonder about the outcome of our work. Well, Susan, that's pretty interesting. You sure do realize quickly that this is a global internet, that's for sure. You definitely have to assume you're being heard across the world. Once you realize that, it can become even more exciting, but you sure do have to watch what you say and realize, you know, this is everybody in the world hearing this. She also told me that Clicky uses a red number to authenticate, which was something she could not see as she is visually impaired. I wrote to them to question their lack of accessibility. You know how grumpy I get when anyone is excluded. I expect I'll hear back from them with a solution. Susan was also intrigued by my description last week of Grand Perspective on the Mac, which was the application that allows you to look at your disk to figure out which files are hogging up all the space. She wrote, regarding the disk space utility, I'm planning to try out the TreeMap version for Windows corresponding to the Grand Perspective for Mac. TreeMap was developed at a really cool information visualization lab at the University of Maryland by a researcher I know there, Ben Schneiderman. They did some studies on how TreeMap and similar tools were used, and it's great to see the product line is out there. Like you, my disk space struggle is never ending. Well, this sounded like fun, so I went off hunting for TreeMap, and I didn't find it directly. Unfortunately, a lot of things are called TreeMap. But in my hunt, I did find an open source tool for Windows that was a snap to install and gave me a beautiful interface, much like Grand Perspective. It's called Winderstat, WINDIRSTAT. You can find it at sourceforge.net/project/Winderstat. And of course, there's a link in the show notes as always. Well, installation of Winderstat took just a few seconds, and then it was asking me to tell it which disk to analyze. I let it go nuts on the C drive, and then it showed a bunch of directories with these little Pac-Man thingies running back and forth. It was kind of fun to be entertained, had no value other than to entertain me. Surprisingly, it didn't have to entertain long, because very quickly it came back with a map with 3 panels. I put a copy of the picture of what it showed me in the show notes. The bottom half is the pretty part, showing the sizes of files by how big the boxes are, and the colors represent the types of files. Then the top half is split into 2 halves. The left allows you to see by directory where you are in the map, and the right side is essentially a color key, showing you, for example, that Windows installer packages are shown in yellow, their extension is .msi, they collectively take up 3.2% of my disk at 266 megabytes for the 66 files. That's just reading one line. I should point out that this is on my virtual machine for using Windows on my Mac through Parallels, so I only have 12 gig in there, which is why the file sizes I'm talking about are so small. The problem with Winderstat is that in the endgame, it has to speak Windows language, which is unfailingly arcane. For example, there's a huge blue square, which is taking up a full 2 gigabytes of my disk. Wow, I better go figure out what that is. Turns out it's called PRISCMPS0.DAD. Well, that's obvious, isn't it? I know exactly what that is. Not. In the menus of Winderstat, I found under Cleanup the command Explorer Here. With the big file selected, I asked for Explorer Here, and it showed me where this big fat file lived. Still didn't tell me what it is. Also under Cleanup, I was able to ask for the properties, where Windows helpfully told me that it was a DAT file of unknown application. It did say it had the attribute archive. I don't know what that means either. Well, the second biggest square on the color diagram turned out to be the exact same name, except instead of 0.dat, it was 1.dat. That was 744 megabytes. So I have nearly 3 gigabytes of disk wasted with something incomprehensible. I'm not blaming Winderstat for this at all. I'm just explaining it can't do magic, it's still dealing with Windows. Well, after I thought about this for a while and I read the name phonetically, I realized it could be something caused by Parallels itself. I'm going to pronounce it rather than spell it. It's parallelscomp0.dat, which could be Parallels Compressor, because they do have this Parallels Compression file. I threw up a post on the Parallels forums to find out if anyone else there has seen it. But in any case, very interesting that it found it. Winderstat also found a rather large square at 250 megabytes, which for an application I thought I had deleted. So I killed that and used Winderstat refresh button, which quickly, very quickly, rescanned and showed the new boxes without that file. Winderstat sorts the folders by size on the left-hand side, and then within the folders it shows the files that are offendingly large. Do you remember I said I wished I'd had that in grand perspective? Well, Winderstat can do it. If you're like Susan and looking to harvest file space on your Windows machine, I start saying Winders because it's Winderstat. It's going to harvest file space on your Windows machine. Anyway, if you're looking for that, check out Winderstat at sourceforge.net for a free and intuitive solution. If you've been following along with our home game, you know I've been testing NeoOffice as a substitute for Microsoft Office. I'm in week 4 of testing and it's going really well, so I thought I'd do a review for the MacReviewCast at MacReviewCast.com with Tim Verporten. Hope you enjoy this review as well. Hi Tim, Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast here. 4 weeks ago, I decided to try using NeoOffice, the open source word processor, spreadsheet, presentation, and drawing program, instead of using Microsoft Office. NeoOffice is based on OpenOffice, which was created by Sun Microsystems and then released out into the wild as an open source project. It was developed to work on Windows, Linux, and Mac OS X. At some point, the developers realized that the interface shouldn't look the same in every operating system. It should look more like the application, you know, that if it were native to that operating system. The early versions running under OS X looked very Windows 95-ish, you know, gray, nasty, square-looking buttons and not all pretty. OpenOffice for the Mac also ran under X11, and it was really slow to launch. It worked okay, but definitely not optimal. Well, NeoOffice 2.1, in contrast, is aquified. It's very pretty and runs natively in OS X without the need for X11. In case you don't follow the whole open source thing, I should say NeoOffice is free to download and use. If you've tried OpenOffice or even NeoOffice a while ago, I really encourage you to go check out the latest version because it's a pretty dramatic improvement. NeoOffice comes with 5 major programs all bundled into one. Instead of opening Excel and Word as 2 separate applications, when you open NeoOffice, you have access to all 5 applications at the same time. This makes the initial load a bit slow, but not too bad compared to opening a lot of applications. The 5 major applications in NeoOffice are called Writer, Calc, Impress, or for some reason they sometimes call it Presenter, Base, and Draw. That's a word processor, spreadsheet, presentation, database, and drawing program. If you use Microsoft Office, you know that the Mac version does not include a database program, while the Windows version does include Access. With NeoOffice, you get a database. I'm hoping to get someone who knows how to use Access for Windows to test out Base for me to see if it's any good and if it can read and write Access databases. You'll also notice from the list that NeoOffice includes a drawing program. I think this is an important addition. I don't know about you, but I'm always trying to draw in PowerPoint, and it's pretty dismal. I know there's better programs out there, but it was what I had. One small but important enhancement of NeoOffice in the presentation mode is that they give us Mac users something the Windows users have enjoyed for years, and that's the slide viewer pane down the left-hand side. Well, I've always been jealous of the Windows guys for that. So much easier to find the slide you're looking for if you can just scroll up and down and see the pictures going by. Ironic that in this case, I prefer working in NeoOffice to working in Microsoft Office because it's as good as the Windows version of Office. It would take too long for me to go through every feature, but on my podcast, I'm doing a tidbit a week describing my experiences using only NeoOffice at work. I've gone for 4 weeks without Microsoft Office. So far, nobody's noticed that I'm sending them files from anything but real Office, which I see as a good litmus test for its usability in a Microsoft-centric environment. More importantly, I've used it in front of people to edit documents and collaborate, and even then they don't notice that it's not Microsoft Office. They're surprised when I tell them it's NeoOffice. I should admit that I've had some issues with NeoOffice, though. Right now, I'm struggling with a document that randomly decides that it shouldn't be single-spaced. This seems to happen on individual lines, and the problem is it's choosing to go to less than single spacing, so it gets all jammed up with the letters sitting on top of each other. I reported it to the forums at trinity.neooffice.org, and so far with other problems, they've been really responsive to my questions, so I expect a solution fairly soon. NeoOffice does publish patches pretty frequently, so each time I've had an issue, I've downloaded the patch and it's gone away. So perhaps the patch 5 that I just downloaded will fix this one. I do think they should make it a bit more obvious when you download NeoOffice that you need to go get the patches. I ran it for about 2 weeks before I even knew about the patches. It turns out they're not included in the downloadable install file for the main program. You have to go patch it. Kind of a Windows view of the thing, huh? Well, I also had trouble when I made a bunch of graphics, like I had these big fat arrows where there was text inside them, and when I reopened the file after I saved it in NeoOffice, it showed them all messed up, squished, shrunk, moved. It's a real botch up. Oddly, the same file opened with those graphics perfectly intact on Windows using Microsoft Office. Well, my next plan is to make the graphics in Draw, which is more flexible anyway, and then paste them as a bitmap into Impress. It's kind of a workaround, and it shouldn't have gone wrong, but there you go. One thing you do have to do to live in a Microsoft world is change the default save options. If you don't, they'll be saved in the Open Document format, which in the future, if we get our way, will be the way we all move documents around. But from now, it's going to kind of freak out your Microsoft friends. It's a little tricky how to do this, how to set all of the files to save properly, so you might want to head over to podfeet.com and check the show notes for this week's show, because in there I'm going to be giving detailed steps and screenshots to get that set correctly. I'm going to keep using NeoOffice until I run into a showstopper, or until in some way it inconveniences someone I need to work with. If you've got a computer without Office on it, I highly recommend checking out NeoOffice for the Mac or OpenOffice for Windows, rather than spending the $150 for the home version of Office. That's about it for this week. Talk to you next week, Tim. Now that it's just us chickens back over on the NoSilicast, I want to go back into a bit more detail on how to set up NeoOffice for saving files. This can make or break how well you integrate into our society until the open document format is widely accepted. So listen up if you don't want to be a pariah. In NeoOffice, open Preferences. When that window comes up, click on Load/Save, and a pull-down arrow will flip down to reveal four options. Click on the General tab. The General section will have all kinds of options, but you want to look partway down to the Default File Format section. There will be two pull-downs, one on the left and one on the right. The left pull-down is for Document Type. The right one is for Always Save As. You're going to pull these down several times, not just once, and that's the confusing part. First, pull down the left side until it says Text Document. On the right side, pull down until it says Microsoft Word 97 2000 XP. So you're saying to save text documents in Word 2000/XP format. Now, of course, it's possible there's some other format you want to use, but up for our purposes, I'm going to stay with this option. Here's where it's not intuitive. Now that you've told it to save text documents to MS Office format, you have to pull down on the left again, set it to Spreadsheet this time, and again set the right one to Microsoft Word 97 2000 XP. I know, it seems redundant, doesn't it? Finally, we'll do it a third time, this time pulling the left side down to Presentation and the right side down to MS Office format. I thought at first they should have had a global change option, but since there are other types of documents in NeoOffice, that really wouldn't make sense to do it that way. For example, there is no Microsoft equivalent to NeoOffice Draw, so what would a global change do there? If you use more than those basic three and you want to interact with others with these files, be sure to keep an eye on the formats and change them appropriately as well. Now you're all set to use NeoOffice in a Microsoft-centric world and no one will be the wiser. Except for you, of course, saving $150. Well, Bart was a whirlwind of information this week. He turned me on to the sweetest little menu bar application. It solves one teeny tiny little annoyance and solves it as simply as possible. You know how sometimes, well, probably lots of times, you're watching a movie in iTunes or maybe something in YouTube or something in QuickTime, and the screen dims just because of the energy-saving settings and you're not touching the keyboard? What if you could temporarily just tell it to quit dimming? Enter caffeine from lightheadsw.com/caffeine. Install caffeine and you'll see three Z's in your menu bar. This means your computer can sleep whenever it feels like it. Click it once, and it's the same three Z's, but now it has an X through it, which means it's not allowed to go to sleep. That's it. That's all there is to it. Sleep on, sleep off. I thought this sounded pretty silly when he told me about it, so I actually didn't put it on right away. But once I did, I find I'm using it all the time. Check out caffeine to keep your computer awake when it should be. Well, it's Memorial Day weekend, and I've got company coming over for a little barbecue, but I did want to get the recording done today, so I did it early. You probably won't get it till later, because I'll probably goof around and not get it uploaded till later anyway. But I want to close up the show for this week to go get ready. This was a great week for feedback from listeners, so keep up the good work by sending me emails at allison@podfeet.com, or if you're in the mood to record your melodious voice, send me a voice recording at nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.